Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Feel free to download these audio files and share them with your friends and family. Please consider joining Beth Emmanuel's virtual community and support our efforts for the kingdom by clicking on the Donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
Shalom, and welcome to Beth Emmanuel. Thank you, everyone, for coming to the services. It's great to have so many guests here on a Sabbath. This is a lot of fun for the whole community, and we love to host these conferences because it makes us feel like a big congregation once or twice during the year. So it's fun, and you add to our Sabbath joy by being here with us. We want to especially welcome our special guest, Rabbi Dr. Schiffman, who is a good friend of First Fruits of Zion and a good friend for Beth Emmanuel. Has given us a lot of input, and we look forward to years of a good relationship, and appreciate so much his being here with us to share today.
Thank you. It's very good to be here. I've been telling people since I've been here that it's always a blessing to come here, and you can be sure it's not because of the weather. You know, I know some of you love the seasons and everything. I only love the one season, summer, which we have in Florida, where I come from. That's why they asked me to speak on the topic this morning, which is return to paradise, because I'm from Florida. It's interesting when you talk about paradise. Now, everybody's begun their lectures with some kind of a joke, which put me under pressure, because I have to come up with one, and of course it has to be better than the other people's jokes. And then I realized it really doesn't have to be better, you just have to tell it better. So this is my best shot. If you don't like it, I'm going home tomorrow, doesn't matter, but try to enjoy it, go along for the ride. There was this cheap miser who died. He had the reputation of never doing anything nice for anybody. And he comes to the gates of paradise. And he starts banging on the door saying, "Let me in." When he gets there, when he's there, finally the door opens and some guy named Peter is there. And he says, "What are you doing here? Because you don't belong here. This is paradise. This is for people who've done good things in their life. I just checked your record. You never did anything good for anybody." And he said, "Well, that's not entirely true. In 1962, I saw a widow with four children, and I gave her a quarter." And he said, "You know, sorry, one good thing isn't enough." And he stopped and he said, "Well, wait a minute. In 1978, there was a guy with a paper cup on a street corner, and he was holding up a cardboard sign that said he was hungry. I really didn't believe him, but I gave him a quarter too." Peter said, "You know, I really need to check with the boss on this, because one thing, I know you won't get in, but two, I'm not so sure." So Peter goes to the boss, and he explains the whole thing, tells him the whole story. He gave a quarter to some old lady in 1962, and then he gave another quarter. He goes, what am I supposed to do?" The Lord said, "Give him his 50 cents and tell him to go to hell." The topic that I was assigned was return to paradise. Now, if you talk to different groups of people, paradise means different things, doesn't it? You know, if you talk to a Muslim terrorist, it's 70 virgins. I saw a sign on Facebook with a group of 70 nuns with shotguns. It said, "Not the virgins you were expecting." I really like that one. That's if you talk to a Muslim terrorist. But you've got to ask yourself, really, what is paradise supposed to be? What is heaven going to be like? If you talk to a Catholic, it's going to be like one big mass forever. If you talk to a Baptist, you know, when we all get to heaven, we're just going to be singing. It's going to be a big song fest. If you talk to a Jewish couple, they'll say, when my son graduates medical school. But when we talk about paradise, it can mean different things. If you look at the scriptures, it doesn't talk a lot about it, but it talks about it. The thing is, I also thought about the majority of the people in our culture who are secular. A lot of them don't believe in heaven. A lot of them don't want to believe in hell. I kind of believe there has to be a hell, mainly because if there's no hell, there's no justice. Without hell, you know, don't worry, I'm not going to spend the time talking about hell. But without hell, the Nazis got away with what they did. So there needs to be a hell for there to be justice. It also means there needs to be a heaven, because this isn't it. You know, you may be having the time of your life, but some of us are struggling. I mean, I had to put on shoes. I mean, I never wear them in Florida. But it's a rough world we live in. It really is. This isn't all there is. Yes, I know, to be that age is so wonderful. When you look at the scriptures, you find a few references. You have the passage brought up yesterday about Abraham's lap and being a place of comfort. You have the thief on the cross who repents to Yeshua, and Yeshua says, this day you will be with me, according to the Hebrew Gospels, in Gan Eden, in the Garden of Eden. But that doesn't tell us a lot about it. Most, you know, if you look on TV, they have, you know, the Philadelphia cream cheese commercial. Basically, you have a bunch of bored angels floating around on clouds eating cream cheese on bagels. Well, I can do that in New York, and believe me, it's not paradise. But what is it? First of all, within Jewish theology, at least in Jewish eschatology, there are two types of references to the Garden of Eden or paradise. One is the physical Garden of Eden. It's called the Garden of Righteousness. Actually, the first one is just a plain earthly terrestrial place. It has beautiful vegetation that was called Lower Garden of Eden. You know, like, you know, the New Jerusalem, the heavenly Jerusalem, the earthly Jerusalem. Same with the Garden of Eden in Jewish literature. The Lower Garden of Eden was the one that Adam was in. The higher Garden of Eden is the place for the righteous. And it's differentiated in Jewish literature. The higher Garden of Eden, the Garden of Righteousness, was created since the beginning of the world, and it appears very gloriously at the end of time. The heavenly chaos are around the throne and upholding the throne of God. It's a place where there are the righteous walking around and there's dancing. People are clothed with white garments. But it's still a bit of a mystery because they didn't know either, because everybody who's gone in that direction didn't come back except for one, and he didn't stay that long. So what do we know? What can we say? There are several things that we can say. You have in Bereshis the miraculous creation being taught, and I want to start with that. You have God calling all things into being. I heard a wonderful black preacher express it this way. He reached out where there was nowhere to reach, and he grabbed something where there was nothing to grab, and he hung something on nothing and told it to stay there. That is the miracle of creation. I like that. But he says, starting in verse 26 of chapter 1, let us make man in our image after our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. In other words, man has total dominion. We are master of the creation that God made. That's point number one. He created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. So, this is it. We're in God's image. God looks like us. You know, you look at the people around you, you go, I could do better. You know, God looks like us. Is that what the scripture's trying to say? And theologians have asked this question for years. First of all, what does it mean to be in the image of God? Because some people have said, well, we walk upright. Well, monkeys can do that, and we know penguins do it. But that's not the image of God. Can it be that we have, you know, these special thumbs that enable, you know, I think it's more to it than that. Some people have said that when we were created in God's image, we have the ability to reflect on our actions. We have the ability to feel compassion. We have the ability to repent and the ability to get angry, something most of the animals don't do. And though I'm speaking on paradise, don't open up any more windows. It's cold in here for me. So those are okay. But the fact is, according to the scriptures, when we read about God, it says that God is clothed in light and hides himself in light. Well, how can you do that? Hide yourself in light? Because the light usually reveals everything, doesn't it? But you know, if this is a dark room and I like appear in great brightness, I have all kinds of lights on me, you won't see me, you'll only see the bright light. In that sense, God is hidden in light. In Moses' repeated encounters with God, it says when he came back from being in the presence of God, what happened to his face? It glowed. He had to put a veil over his head because he didn't want people seeing that glow fade away. When Yeshua appeared at the Mount of Transfiguration, how is it rendered in the... in the Delage, Mount of Transfiguration. You wouldn't call it Transfiguration Mountain. That sounds like a Disney ride. But when he was there, it says that Moses and Elijah appeared, and Yeshua became white. His clothes became white, whiter than any laundry soap, and his face shone, and he was bright. This is a picture of what God was like, and this or is like, and a picture of what we were like when we were created. How do I know this? I'll come to it. First of all, it says in the rabbinic literature, when Adam was created, his appearance was such that when the angels first saw him, they bowed down, thinking that he was God. Why? Because he was in light. He was bathed in light. He glowed. Here's a second question. It says in chapter 3 of Bereshis, the serpent was more crafty than any other beast in the field that God had made. He said to the woman, did God actually say, you shall not eat of any tree in the garden? And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden." But God said, "You shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die." But the serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die, for God knows when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And she gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate. Then the eyes of both were opened, and they knew that they were naked. That never made sense to me. If you're naked, do you know it? Have you ever once been naked and not known you were naked? We know when we are, because we take such care to cover ourselves. Usually in expensive clothes or something. I go to the thrift store. But either way, we know when we're naked, because it's a different feeling. It's a different state of being. But their eyes were opened. Suddenly they were seeing what they didn't see before. Why? Because when they sinned, the light went out. All of a sudden, they weren't glowing anymore. And it was like, whoa! They hopped in the bushes. They grabbed a couple of fig leaves. That didn't last very long. God had compassion on them and created clothes for them, animal skins. Animals died that they would be clothed. But the light had gone out. The light in the Torah is called the reflection of God's glory that was on Moses' face. We had a bit of God's glory that we were clothed in. When Yeshua rose from the dead, he shone. And when he reappears in the book of Revelation, he's glowing. I believe that when we return to paradise, to Gan Eden, we will be glowing again. Maybe we won't need clothes. This may not matter to you so much. When I was a child, my mother and I were talking about Garden of Eden and sin. Why? Because I grew up in an Orthodox home where we really believed in God. My mother was the first person that ever taught me that God loved me. And one day I was having a conversation with her. I was about the age of this one here. You can't see him because he's crawling onto the pew, but that's all right. And I said, "Mom, is it really true that if Adam didn't sin, we all would have still been in the Garden of Eden?" And she said, "That's right." I said, "But that means we all would have been naked?" And she said, "That's right." I said, "Even Jack Benny?" She said, "Yeah, I guess Jack Benny too." I said, "I'm not so sure I like that." The point is, a return to Eden means a return to that body that reflected the light of God. That when angels saw, they bowed down because they thought man was God, because we were in God's image. We're still in God's image, but in a diminished form. So what does it mean? Are we going to be like the Baptists and singing all day long and every night and all the time for 1,000 years? I don't know about you, but I think that would get boring. I can only take music so long. I like music. I love music. And for those of you who are sharing in music, thank you. I really do appreciate it, and it's uplifting. I think I got myself out of that one. No, but seriously, I really do like music. But, you know, for 1,000 years of nothing but music, it gets old. New gets old after a while. Is it going to be like one big mess? I certainly hope not. I love a good Shacharis service, but I look forward to when it ends too. You know, I can only stand so long, and even sitting, you know, after a while I'd need a special pillow. But the thing is, you can only take it so long. Too much of a good thing, they say. What is the Garden of Eden? What was it like? Well, it says that God, it wasn't even, Eden isn't paradise. The garden, which we call paradise, was located in Eden. And it was located between these four rivers, and it was fertile, and everything was good on every side. When I think back of what it was like, you know what I think of? When I was in seventh grade in science class, we made a terrarium. Did any of you ever make a terrarium? You know, you get like an old fish tank that probably had a crack in it and wouldn't hold water anymore. And you put, you know, some gravel in it, and then you put some dirt in it. And then you buy these little plants. I bought little palm trees, you know. It was prophetic. I was moving to Florida later. But, you know, you plant the little trees in it. You could put a little turtle in it or a little salamander. And then you put some water in it and you cover it. You never have to touch it again because the water hits the top of the glass and then it comes down again, kind of like self-waters. You have to put little flies in for the salamanders. But basically, it's a self-contained ecological unit. I got an A on that one, by the way. It was almost paradise. But I think that's what it was like when God first set up the garden. Because it says when he created everything, in verse 5 of chapter 2, when no bush of the field was yet in the land, and no small plant of the field had yet sprung up, For the Lord God had not caused it to rain on the land, and there was no man to work the ground, and a mist was going up from the land and watering the whole face of the ground. Well, that's what a terrarium does. It kind of has this misty, you know, the evaporation, it comes down again. It's not quite rain, it's more like a mist. I think that's what it's describing. But the earth isn't a terrarium. If you read some of the books, a book by Periwinkle on the flood, which is later on in chapter 6, it talks about the way that the windows of heaven opened and the waters came down. It's believed that there was a canopy of ice around the earth, kind of like Saturn's rings. And when the flood started, this canopy collapsed, which caused this, you know, that's why you have tropical plants in the stomach of elephants, what were they, mammoths, in the North Pole. How could you have mammals like that, you know, eating tropical plants in the North Pole? Well, if the place was a big terrarium, it would make sense. If it all collapsed, and it says that the way that the animals were preserved, they were like quick frozen, because all this stuff came down and frozen. Now, that's not about paradise, but if it was like a big terrarium with like tropical environment, it was like paradise. It was like the, I think it's describing that type of a climate and situation in the original creation. So you have this situation, and it's well watered, it says rivers are coming and everything, and it says God created Adam and told him to take care of the garden. You go, well, how many of you are into gardening, by the way? I'm not, I'm a city kid. I was born in Manhattan. You know, my idea of a garden is, you know, they mowed the lawn somewhere. I mean, it's like, I'm not a gardener. I don't plant stuff. You know, when I pick my fruit and vegetables, it's at the supermarket. You know, it's wrapped nicely. It's clean, you know. If you're a gardener and you like it, is it peaceful? Is it calming? God told Adam and Eve, take care of the garden. I've seen people work in their gardens. I hire somebody. They till the garden, they plant flowers, they create beautiful things, and they're very happy doing that because it's peaceful. I'm not a garden person. But you know, when I wake up in the morning, I make a cup of coffee, and I sit outside on the lanai, which is a Florida way of saying the patio. And I sit out there, and I've got all these birds singing. And I don't even think about it, but it's peaceful. My blood pressure goes down. I have palm trees around. I listen to the birds. I have American bald eagles that have a nest like 400 feet from my house in a cell tower, which I thought ruined the view until I saw the eagles, and then it became cool. But I sit there and I watch the eagles go back and forth, and they bring food to their young, and I listen to other birds singing, and I look at the palm trees, and it's peaceful, and it's calm, and it's relaxing. That's why when you come to Florida, they say, "Welcome to paradise." Now, that's advertising. But the reality is, paradise, whatever it was a peaceful place, a place where you didn't have stress. The number one killer of mankind is stress. Any of you going through stress? Any of you? It's a pretty peaceful place up here, huh? Yeah? How's it working for you, the stress? It's good for you? It makes you feel good? You could feel it taking years off your life. Paradise, whatever it's going to be, is not going to be stressful. Paradise, whatever it's going to be, is going to be relaxing and peaceful. With work. God told Adam and Eve to work in the garden. Why? Because you got to have something to do. If we bore easily, how much more do you get bored doing nothing, sitting in paradise? God told him to till the garden. When you have nothing to do and you're bored out of your mind, wouldn't you rather be doing something, anything? You know, it's like you see something you don't like to do, but you have nothing to do and you're bored, and you see, "Can I help you with that? Can I try that? That looks interesting." It really doesn't. You just want to do something to not be bored. We don't know a whole lot about what will be. Yes, we'll be singing in angelic choirs. We'll be blessing God's name. The rabbis conceived of us sitting in great yeshiva, studying the Torah and studying the Gemara day and night. Abraham and Isaac and Jacob all had their own yeshivas. And the idea was to sit and study with them. Maybe so. Because when you study, that's work, but you learn, you don't get bored, you get occupied. We were created to be light and to give light. Most people want to wait for heaven until the day comes. You know, when you sleep. When you sleep with your fathers. I was thinking of being a New Yorker, sleep with the fishes, you know, when they put you in the river. But the interesting thing is, when you slept with your fathers, it says in the text says, gathered to your fathers. And it just doesn't mean this spiritual seeing your parents again and your grandparents. I think it does that too. But there was a physical sense to it. Because the ancient graves of families, what they would do is they laid you out on this stone thing, and as your body went back to natural, you know, everything would drip off it, and there was a thing, it would go away. That's why a grave was an unclean place. And eventually it would just be bones. And then when they'd use the crypt again for the next person who died in your family, they'd take the bones and they'd sweep them all down to the end. So in a sense, you were literally gathered to your fathers. It's not a joke, it's true. They were your bones, their bones, all became one. And there was that, and it became a metaphor for the spiritual reality of being gathered to your loved ones. And part of the idea of paradise was being gathered to those we love, because we're aware that our lives here and now are not all there is to life. I mean, you are aware of that, right? There's more to come. And I guess that's what I'm supposed to be telling you about. There is more to come. But the thing that's important is we see the loved ones, and that's important. I have a deep connection with my grandparents, as well as my parents. My parents live in Florida, though. My grandparents are living in the world to come. I look forward to seeing them again. And all this business of arguing over who saved heaven and hell and everything else, the biggest problem with the kind of argument it is, I'm not going to get into the theology of it, is that you rob people of the hope of seeing the people they love. And that's not a good thing. The good news is not that you never get to see your loved ones again. The good news is that you're going to get to glow again because of the faithfulness of Yeshua. We're going to get our glow back. And I think that's important because we struggle, Paul wrote, we struggle against our own flesh. Everything we want to be was what we were in the garden. Everything we hope to become is what we were in that garden. No one knows, even Paul wrote, it does not appear as yet as what we shall be, but when he appears, we shall be like him. The light's going to go back on, and we're going to be like that. And that's a good thing. Why didn't God tell us more? Because God doesn't want us to follow Yeshua just so we can get the, you know, get that little thing, that nifty little thing that you get. God wants us to follow Yeshua out of faithfulness. He wants us to trust in him. He wants us to live lives of integrity, live lives of godliness, here and now. One of the things that I really like, one of the writers I find very interesting was C.S. Lewis. I don't mean his Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe stuff, which always has some interesting things, but he conceived of the life after this one as a continuation and intensification of whatever this life was that we lived. If you were a miserable old something or other in this life, you're just going to become more miserable and you're not going to be in the good place. But if in your heart you try to live before God, although not perfect, you will become more and more of that. Whatever your heart's desires were, whatever your values were towards others, those will intensify. If you hate people, you're going to be awfully alone and hateful in the world to come. But if you love people, and if you love God, you'll become more like that. Because we all love God to one level or another. I love God. I grew up loving God. I come from a family that loves God. But in my heart, I feel I don't love him as much as I should, or as much as I want to. But in that day, I will. I'm going to love him so much, I'm going to glow. You don't know what you're going to be like. The important thing, I kind of see myself like an Andy Rooney type. I'm always complaining about something. But it's always for a godly cause. You know how it is. You know, they're just not righteous enough. They don't know, you know. But how do you feel towards other people? Yeshua judged people on how they were towards others, not on how many commandments they were perfect on. It's good to keep the commandments, and it's good to do the best you can. But you can't treat people like garbage and say you love God. You can't look down on people and say you truly love God. True godliness cannot exist apart from human decency. If you want to glow in the world to come, you need to live as a decent human being to to the people around you now. What does that mean? You always have to smile? No. I come from the land of sunshine. People are always smiling. I'm from the land of that little island I told you about, you know, New York. We don't smile all the time in New York. Someone slips on a banana peel, we smile. But normally, we don't smile all the time. And some people say, well, I don't like New Yorkers because they're never, you know, nice. You know, but meanwhile, you come to Florida and everyone's, hi, how you doing, you know, and they're so happy to see you. If you got a problem and tell them, they don't want to hear about it. There are a lot of people in our society that want to smile at you and they want to be friendly to you, but they don't want to be your friend. If you need them, sorry, I got to go. Or you tell them your problem and they go, gee, that's too bad. See ya. You know, I got to go. I got to, you know, there's something on TV I want to watch. Your problems don't matter to them. New Yorkers are a little different that way. We won't smile unless somebody falls. But if you need help, they will help you. People saw this, were shocked on 9/11 when New Yorkers were, they showed them, New Yorkers are going out of their way to help one another. No one believed New Yorkers would do this because we're not polite people. But we'll help people. Which is better to be? I'm not saying that as a New Yorker, I'm saying which is better for us to aspire to. I don't care if you smile at me or not. Of course, New Yorkers, sometimes we give gestures that aren't, you don't even use your mouth, it's hand gestures. But we call it the, never mind. But New Yorker, if you say to somebody, how do I get to this place? A New Yorker will walk two blocks out of his way to take you there or to point out where you have to go. And most people go, I don't believe that. When I talk to New Yorkers, other New Yorkers go, yeah, that's right, that they don't get it. What's my point? Not that you should be a New Yorker. I don't want to hear any bad language that's reserved for New Yorkers to use. But it means we go out of our way for one another. We encourage one another, and we try to help one another. That is a taste of the world to come. You want me to do something to encourage you? Okay, I did the blessing yesterday. Was it yesterday or the day before? Yesterday? Day before. Okay. If you were here, you got a blessing. If you didn't, you missed it. But let me tell you something to encourage you. Normally, I don't come out of my deep South environment at this time of year. The reason I came here, I would come anyway because Boaz asked me to. If Boaz asked me to do a lot of things, I would do it because I respect him and he's my friend. But I also wanted to come here because I really like you guys. I like what you're doing. I like the trajectory your congregation is taking. I know you've paid a big price to do this, and it hasn't been easy. But I really think you're doing good stuff, and it blesses me to see you do it. And if there's any way I can be an encouragement or blessing to you without smiling, I want to do it. But I want you to know, I think what you're doing will have strong, positive ramifications for a lot of congregations and a lot of places in the future. How do I know this? Because 15 years ago, almost none of the Messianic congregations did anything with traditional liturgy. And I started using the siddur in prayer. I showed up at a UMJC conference. I started their morning minions. I grabbed a few people, I called them before and said, bring your tefillin. And we started laying tefillin and having morning services. Now all of a sudden it's institutionalized. It's, you know, so we've always done it. We didn't always do it. We started it in 1974. Or was it 72? No, sorry, 94. I started doing that. And I had, in 96, I had one of the leaders of the UMJC, Tony Eaton, say to me, you know, you really have had a big effect. You must feel very good to see people starting to embrace the Jewish worship style with the siddur and the liturgy. I said, yeah, it feels good, but why are they starting to do it? And they didn't do it before. He said, he was saying, I caused it. He said, because we didn't know it could be done. We didn't think you could do it without walking away from Yeshua. And you showed us that you could. It was like, wow, I didn't realize that. I just wanted to worship that way. What you're doing is showing people that it can be done. And that's a really good thing, and it's an important thing. People you never will meet, people you'll never realize that you had an effect on, you will have a strong effect on. Now, is that paradise? No. We haven't gotten there yet. But I expect that someday I'll see you there, and when I do, we will admire each other's glow. Because you're going to glow. The other important thing to recognize about the paradiso, paradise, or the garden, is that the effect it has should be the effect we have on people. I want you to stop and think about this. What effect does your life have on people around you? Do you make people at ease? Do you make them feel good? Or do you bring tension on them? Like, oh, here they come. You ever have anyone do that when you walk into the room? There was a movie with Bette Midler, Big Business or something, where she and Lily Tomlin are twins, switched at birth, and so there's a set of each of them, and Bette Midler's playing this big businesswoman. She inherited everything, very powerful. And she's like coming up in the elevator, and all of a sudden she stops at her floor, and she takes on this tone like she's looking to intimidate everybody. Do you ever have that effect on people? You shouldn't look to do it. Because people will see you and they're going to want to go running in the other direction. I was a student for 12 years of a Breslov rabbi. I was a master sofer. That's part of my background. And he used to tell me about Rebbe Nachman. Rebbe Nachman is the Breslov Rebbe, died in 1809. He was 37 years old when he passed away. He lived during the Haskalah movement. The Haskalah was what? The Enlightenment. It's when a lot of Jews became secular. They didn't dress, you know, in traditional Hasidic garb. Well, that came in later. They dressed in like worldly garb. They shaved their beards. They didn't want to hear about God. You ever meet people like that today? Most of the Rebbes, the Hasidim, they'd come with their big strimals, the fur hats, and they'd have their entourage of people, and they'd see the Haskalah Jews, and they'd spit, and they'd walk away. What did Rebbe Nachman do? He dressed up in regular clothes, not religious clothes, kind of like what I'm wearing. And he'd sit with them in the park and play chess. And when you play chess, you talk with people. And they knew he was a Rebbe. Rebbe Nachman would dress like a Hasid on Shabbat for the honor of Shabbat, but during the week, he would dress like normal people. Why? Because he didn't want to scare people away. He wanted to draw people. And when he would draw them, he would talk to them. He would let them know about the love of God. They would see the love of God in his life. If they needed something, he was there. Sometimes they might tell him a joke or something or whatever, and if they needed something, they'd say, Rabbi, can I talk to you? I've kind of patterned my own ministry after that. The important thing is to be religious, but you don't have to seem so religious. If I seem religious, I'm going to scare people. I scare people away anyway. My wife says, we were talking about something like this in my Havara, and I said, well, I try to draw people. My wife says, no, dear, you intimidate people. I go, I do not. And she starts to say, does he intimidate you? And they say, well, not anymore, because I got to know him. But if they don't know me well enough, they're intimidated. And then I pulled up my New York and said, well, that's not bad at all. But, you know, really, the fact is, you don't want to intimidate people. You don't want to put pressure on them. And you don't want them to be sorry that you walked into the room. You want people to see the love of God in you. Someday they'll see the glow of God on us. But the closest we get to it now is that they might see the love of God in us. Because for here and now, that's as close as we get to the garden. What effect are you having on the people around you? Are they drawn to you or repelled by you? Because you are his workmanship, created for good works in the Mashiach. You were intended that people would see Yeshua in you, that you might be the bearer of Yeshua to them. That's how we do our work in Eastern Europe. I've talked about this last time. We don't try to be the mouth of God. Enough people are jabbering, trying to be his mouth, like me. We try to be the hands of God. If people are hungry, you feed them. If they're thirsty, you give them something to drink. If they're naked, you clothe them. Yeshua said, if you did it for the least of these, my brothers, you do it to me. You did it for me. We become the hands of Yeshua to the world around us. Well, maybe you don't have people around you who are hungry or thirsty or naked, but you have people around you who have empty lives, lives of darkness and sadness. You have people who are hurting, probably sitting right beside you. What they need is the love of God. And that's something that you are more than adequately capable of showing. You want a little bit of paradise? Bless somebody else. Be a blessing, and that'll give you a foretaste of what it will be like. My beloved, it does not appear as of yet as what we shall be. But when he appears, we shall be like him. We should start on that now.